You seek the key, but first you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today. Okay, let's do some quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. That's obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. To reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. Here's the thing. Information is power. Information is money. Literally, the currency of today's world of entrepreneurship is information. And if you could bring all of the information about your business into one dashboard, this is incredibly valuable. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of the truth about your business. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, access from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. And you're improving efficiency by bringing all of your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. This is so valuable. You just hit a button and you can see all the information about your business instead of having to like call five different departments and get all these emails and put it all together and make sense of it. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show on the Stansberry Radio Network.
This is James Altucher. Welcome again to the James Altucher Show, and I have Judy Jew, Iron Chef Judy Jew, on the show. Now, Judy, do people actually use that as a title? Like, do they call you Miss Iron Chef or anything like that?
You know what? It's funny because, yeah, kind of. I mean, just because I do so much of Iron Chef in the States as well in terms of judging, that they always introduce me as Iron Chef UK, Judy Jew, and I think that's part of the franchise is trying to, you know, enforce into the watcher that it is this, like, worldwide global franchise, and there's Iron Chef Thailand and Iron Chef Australia and Iron Chef Vietnam and Japan, and so it's just kind of, I don't know, maybe it's this title, like, president, once you have it, you always have it, I guess.
There's a lot of interesting things in your background, and we'll get into the whole meat of the story in a second, but do all the Iron Chefs ever get together for, like, dinner, and everyone's just, like, criticizing the restaurant?
Well, you know, in America, we did this epic Iron Chef global battle where they flew in the Iron Chef from Thailand, they flew in the guys from Australia, and if they flew in me from the UK, and so, you know, we kind of had this big powwow. We didn't go up against each other and go out to dinner, but I think if we did, it would be a lot of critiquing. But
a lot of knives being pulled out.
Yeah. We just take food for what it is.
Have you ever met, like, the original Iron Chef, you know, Chairman Kaga?
No, never. I would love to, though. He's crazy.
Wow, he's kind of, like, mysterious and in the background now.
Yeah. I mean, I'm kind of obsessed with that original series. It was very cultish and kind of crazy. Yeah.
Well, so let's lead up to that, because your story is so interesting to me. You've totally... You're what I call a choose-yourself person. You chose yourself to basically have the career of your dreams, because you started off with a completely different career. So
yeah.
why don't you you know, rather than me saying it to the audience, why don't you say, what was your original job? You know, where did you come from?
Well, I came from New Jersey. So
where in New Jersey? I'm from New Jersey.
I was born in Summit, New Jersey, lived in Berkeley Heights, went to school in Summit, and then, you know, had a tiger mother upbringing, very classic Asian immigrant parents. You know, had to go to certain schools, so I ended up at Columbia University majoring in engineering, and from there, went into finance. I was at Morgan Stanley selling fixed income derivatives for about 5 years. And then, I decided I couldn't take that anymore and enrolled in cooking school at the FCI in Soho, New York, and never looked back. And so I've kind of had this, like, choose-your-own-adventure type of life where I was kind of embarking on different things all along the way.
That totally is a choose-your-own-adventure, but we have to take a step back just because what was going on Wall Street? Like, what was going through your head? What did you do? Like, I know you were there for about 5 years, so that's a long time. You know, you were building a real career there with potentially tens of millions of dollars you were leaving on the table.
and when I was there, it was so long ago, it was, you know, money grew on trees type Wall Street days. And I just didn't love it. I mean, I was like, okay, I'm schlepping bonds. I don't love bond math. I don't love fixing
companies. I thought everybody loved bond math.
You know, like, I couldn't care less about, like, convexity and duration and all these words. And I just got, I don't know. I mean, I was good at it. I worked with great people. You know, everybody's really smart in the financial services and very driven, like, type A personalities, which is kind of fun to be in such an environment where you're always learning and you're learning through osmosis. And but I just couldn't take it anymore, and I found that all I wanted to do on the weekends was just to read cookbooks and cooking magazines and get into food.
So you loved cooking. You were working Wall Street during the week, but you just were obsessed with cooking and food and everything. Were you into cooking as a kid?
Yeah, I would say I'm more obsessed with eating versus cooking, which, you know.
Now people are going to get this image that you're like 600 pounds. I just want to say for the audience, you are the opposite of that. You do not look like you eat very much at all. So,
Asian girls, we have this, you know, wooden leg that's hidden and invisible to the rest of the world, where we just, like, chow down and everything goes into the wooden leg.
That must be true, because when I look at your photos, it does not look like you are an eater. But you're obsessed with eating.
Yeah, and also just because of my strong science background, the world of cooking, as well as, you know, particularly pastry, really appealed to me. I mean, working in a kitchen is just like working in a laboratory where you have controls and variables, you're doing experiments. You know, it matters if you cook something low or slow or under high heat. It matters what kind of fat you use, if it's butter or lard or oil. It makes a big difference if you whisk something, mix something, or fold it.
So like, your engineering background oddly applied to both Wall Street and cooking. Like, you're able to kind of take a similar skill set and apply it in both directions.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, yeah, cooking is all science. I think science is applied to many different things in life, yeah.
But when you're on Wall Street, though, again, like, how did you decide, okay, this is a huge decision, I'm going to leave, you know, again, millions of dollars on the table, and I'm going to go to the French Culinary Institute for school? Like, that must have been, like, your parents must have been going crazy.
Oh, yeah, they're, like, suicidal, practically. And you know what? I was my husband at the time. He was just like, you know what? Just do what you want. He was really supportive, and he kind of acted as my sponsor, like my Medici, if you will. I was like, you do this. Go back to school, reinvent yourself, become a student again, and find out what color your parachute is. And I never thought in a million years if it would lead to this. You know, I thought I'd have, like, really cool birthday parties for my kids or something. But it ended up turning into a viable career.
When were you at the French Culinary Institute?
I haven't been there in a while, but I am going on Monday.
No, but I mean, when did you go to school there?
Oh, when did I go? Oh, sorry. I graduated 2004.
Okay, because I've eaten there. They just, so people know, this is on Broadway, right? And it's a restaurant also where the students cook.
It's true. It's called Le Cole. It's in Soho on Broadway in New York City. Yep.
And it's excellent. I've eaten there a few times. The students cook great. Maybe you've even cooked for me before there. So
possibly.
So it was very good.
Yeah.
And
very
so
fun.
So then what happened? You then went. So first off, I just want to see what the leap is, and I don't know if you've ever really spoken about this, but
yep.
Did you have, like, money in the bank that was comfortable so you could make this leap? Or, like, how much money were you leaving on the table when you left Wall Street? Because I think people are always afraid when they make that jump that they just, they can't do it because they're never going to be able to pay their bills if they pursue their passion.
True.
So,
it's
like,
true.
What did it take for you to make that jump, just financially?
I mean, financially, I mean, I did have savings, you know, because, I mean, back then you're getting paid quite handsomely, even at my level, and you're working so much you don't even have time to spend your money, you know? Like, I think I took 1 week of vacation the entire year.
So what does that mean? Like, that doesn't mean $100 million. What does it mean?
No.
Seven figures?
No, I wouldn't say that. I would say like healthy six digits in the bank, you know. But I mean, I really got supported by my husband. You know, he continued working in finance, and I didn't have to, you know, provide all of the rent. You know, I had him, you know, paying for most of my living expenses, which was great. So I really have to, I kind of owe it to him for being my sponsor in that sense. But it's difficult, you know. You really have to downgrade your life.
And is your, skipping ahead, is your life more hectic now or less hectic? Because you're both a chef and a TV star.
It's crazy, but it's so fun. I mean, I definitely have a very high fun factor with my job. I don't know what I'm going to be doing. I don't know what I'm going to be filming. You know, like I just did a live TV show the other day, which was crazy. I just, I just came from another interview now, just promoting Korean Food Made Simple. And so my days are really varied. And of course, I have my restaurant in London. I'm working on new concepts now as well. And yeah, it's like being an entrepreneur, which I think is fun because you get to be creative, you're working for yourself, and you get to be involved in projects that you want to be involved in.
Well, it's very much an entrepreneur. You're like a solopreneur where your different media outlets are various streams of income, and you are constantly trying to improve yourself, improve your exposure to your audience, and develop different, you know, income streams from it.
Yeah. Definitely.
So how did you make the initial jump to, you know, being a chef? First off, was your boss flipping out when you told them what you were going to do from Wall Street?
No. I mean, everybody in finance is really, you know, professional and supportive. I actually just had drinks with my old boss the other day here in New York, and they love it. You know, it's kind of like the person who escaped and actually made it.
Yeah, they're all jealous. They all want to be
comic
book artists and chefs and all this stuff, and you did it.
Yeah. And I mean, a lot of people do make the switch, but it's, you know, I've been very lucky and very blessed that I've made the switch, and it's happened in such a way where it's, you know, getting on TV, doing the Iron Chef thing, and I've made the switch, and it's actually worked, you know, in a way that I never imagined.
But it wasn't just luck. So you basically trained yourself at one of the best schools to train yourself to be a chef. And then you're, from what I understand, correct me if I'm wrong, you're in Gordon Ramsay's restaurant, and you basically introduce yourself to him, and he says, come and work for me. Like, this is like a dream come true. How did that happen?
I mean, you know, the common perception that it's very hard to get a job in these kitchens, it's actually not that hard to get a job there. It's hard to stay. Because they haze you, it's brutal, the hours are crazy, you know, and it's just a very physically tiring and demanding environment. You know, you're working long hours, you're in front of a hot stove, or you're on your feet for you know, forever, and it's just tough, you know.
What do you mean by hazing? Like, do they try to give you, like, bad ingredients and make you cook something?
No.
Or
what
happened?
You have to, you know, like, they give you a fork and you have to juice, like, five crates of lemons with it. Or, like, you get, like, you know, bushels and bushels of, like, spinach, and you have to pick the stems off, you know, so you get like crazy, mundane, monotonous jobs like that basically take 4 hours.
And is this Gordon Ramsay doing this hazing, or just the other co-workers in the kitchen?
other Gordon, by that time, was already well into his television career. I've only met him a few times, yeah.
But he's the one who initially hired you for the kitchen, though.
Yes, but, I mean, he just happened to be there, yeah.
Wow. So that is really kind of an element of luck to it.
There is, and I think that in life that luck does play a part, but I think to a certain extent you also make your own luck, and you know, you can meet all the right people and it can never amount to anything, or you can meet the right people and make an impact and make something change in your life.
Let's look at how you made your own luck. So you had savings. Yeah. You made the decision to quit a very high paying job, which is very hard to do. You went to school for cooking, even though you know you basically started at the bottom, coming from the top of your field, going to the bottom of a field, and then you went to the best restaurant in the world and got hired by the best chef in the world after introducing yourself to him. So you very much created your own luck. Like, luck favors the prepared. And you were very prepared.
Yeah, it's true. I think that one thing also is that because I have a strong education, as well as because I am coming from the corporate world, I've been, you know, like part of that is like you're used to like networking. You're used to public speaking. You're used to saying and meeting people and following up and working hard. And I think that all of that is part of the equation to become successful in anything that you do.
That's a really great point. And so now this is really just the beginning of your career when you're in the kitchen there. How did this go from, you know, the next phase, which enters the media stuff?
So I was working there. I was freelancing. I was writing. I started doing appearances on TV shows out in London, regular guest appearances, cooking, doing demos. And then the Iron Chef UK.
How did that happen? Like, how did you start doing, you know, guest appearances places? Like, how did you put yourself out there?
I met a producer just at a restaurant opening, and she just liked me, liked what I had to say, you know, thought I was television friendly. I'm not a complete eyesore, so, which is part of the battle with television also. And
that's my problem. That's why we're doing an audio only podcast.
No.
Well, like when you say she liked what you had to say, what did you have to say? You were just talking about like cooking.
Yeah, talking about cooking, but also I was talking about Korean food, and Korean food, you know, was relatively still unknown back then. And everybody's always curious about different ethnic cuisines. Plus, I'm a female, so, you know, female chefs are very far and few, so she really wanted to promote, you know, more women chefs, so I have that going for me as well. And also, like, everybody loves this career changer story, so it's just the fact that I have such a different background as well. So I had a number of things that kind of make me different than your regular Italian chef, I say, which are like 1,000 of them, and just took it from there.
Well, let me ask you about that. Like, most women cook. Most men don't cook. I don't know if this sounds sexist or what, but it's just like the reality.
Yeah.
Everybody talks about their mother's cooking. Why are all the famous chefs male, and there's very few famous female chefs when it's the mothers who did all the cooking?
You know what, I think that just has to do with the fact that the kitchen environment is really difficult. It's long, long hours. It's physically exhausting. It's physically demanding, you know, and I think it's just not conducive or friendly. It's not necessarily a very, if you're going to play stereotypes, a female-friendly environment, I guess, in the same way that the training floor isn't either. There's lots of yelling and screaming, swearing, and you see very few women on the training floor. Now it's getting better. It's getting better in kitchens as well, but it's not one of these, I guess, stereotypical areas that women choose to be in.
That's really funny, because I would scream at my ex-wife all the time when she was cooking. So now you meet this producer, and she starts booking you for all these gigs, and what happens next?
the Iron Chef casting call comes around, and the entire country goes for it just because it's such a powerful franchise and brand, and everybody's heard the show or seen the show in some form in the U.S. or in the original Japanese version, etc. And I go to casting call after casting call, and ended up landing the gig. So one of the four Iron Chefs in the UK, and use that as a platform because the production company who does it in the States consulted on the production in the UK. And they brought me over to do judging for Next Iron Chef and Iron Chef America. So I've been one of the resident stable judges on that show for a number of years now, which is completely fun. And doing more and more work with Food Network and Cooking Channel, obviously, with my show out on Cooking Channel now, with Korean Food Made Simple. And, yeah, it's kind of been a wild ride, and television is part of it.
And you run a restaurant in London.
Yes. So... the Playboy Club, they found me through Iron Chef. And I have to say it was a bit of a, you know, cheeky marketing move on their behalf to put a female in front of their kitchen. And it's been fun. I mean, they put me in front of a lot of different feminist reporters and, you know, somebody, and obviously, you know, I'm educated, I'm somewhat articulate, and just can handle all of the questions. And in this day and age, I don't really find that Playboy is at risque anymore. I mean, it's almost cute. You know, you can't even watch a music video without seeing things that are more salacious than what you find with the Playboy brand, honestly. So it's fun. I think life is about creating memories also, and there's a massive fun factor with working like with a brand like Playboy.
Sure.
And a super brand. It's got 98% worldwide recognition, and it's been hysterical, fun, challenging, everything above. Yeah.
Well, I mean, is it a popular restaurant? Like, when I think Playboy, I don't think food.
It's a casino. It's a big venue. We have a casino. It's a high rolling casino. It's members only. It is a fine dining restaurant. We have private dining rooms, private gaming rooms, a cigar terrace and lounge, cocktail bar area, sports bar, and a nightclub.
And what were some of the things that you did to kind of put your own mark on the restaurant once you started there?
Well, it's American food in its essence, but I do a lot of Korean and Asian twists. Like, we make our own kimchi at the Playboy Club, which I think is great. We have a lot of Asian-infused dishes, a lot of Korean elements and end up on the menu, which I think is very natural right now. You can't seem to go out without finding kimchi on some part of a menu and anywhere in New York City. You know, like I also, like in my sports bar, I have all the great American bar food, you know, so I do really amazing buffalo wings made with, you know, fantastic artisanal cheese for the blue cheese sauce, and we use great wings, and I've kind of made this bespoke hot sauce that we dip them in, and it's, so everything, even if it's simple as a buffalo wing, is made with a lot of care and trying to perfect it, so it's absolutely delicious.
Oh, my God, I can't even think of a buffalo wing that would be delicious. So tell me, what should I do? Like, let's say I have chicken. How can I make a delicious buffalo wing?
Well, I think I'm kind of a purist. I think you have to use Frank's Red Hot Sauce.
Okay.
Which is part of the original equation. Yeah, and then to that, I add a whole slew of stuff. So a lot of people will just use the Frank's Red Hot Sauce, like, in its pure form, but I don't. I like to add some brown sugar, sweeten it up, some garlic. I like to add mustard to give it a bit more depth of flavor, even, you know, a little bit of ginger sometimes. I mean, so you can add a whole bunch of other things, like shallots, to kind of make that hot sauce have a bit more depth of flavor and complexity.
How did you think to add mustard to something like that?
Mustard's good on everything.
Okay, that's a good thing to know. What if I'm having, like, pasta?
Yeah,
I
love mustard, yeah.
All right, what's another recipe I can make, like, tonight for my new wife, who I don't scream at?
I think you should make... I have a really great recipe that I've done on Korean Food Made Simple called Bosam, which is a twice-cooked pork belly. It's just awesome in every way.
Now you're talking my language.
Yeah.
So twice cooked, what does that mean? Because I don't know anything. So, like, I put it in the oven twice?
So basically you take skinless, well, a pork belly. It has a skin on, boneless though, and you just boil it a couple of hours, maybe 3 hours, with some Asian aromatics. So you got ginger, garlic, some scallions, onion, a few peppercorns if you want, and some Korean soybean paste or miso paste. Mm. Boil that till it's really soft, and then take it out, rip the skin off, and then you make a really kind of succulent glaze, which I do with some Korean chili sauce, honey, sweeten it up, sesame oil, and you smear that all over the top of it, and with some soy sauce and ginger again, and then you bake that in the oven, broil it, get it all caramelized and nice, and take it out, slice it thinly, and then you throw it on top of some rice with some lettuce leaves and some samjang sauce if you want to, or you can make another sauce or a schmear with some doenjang, sesame seeds, some ginger, onions, and just shove that in your mouth, and it's addictive.
Wow, I might, if I could, I'm going to have to play back this recording, and I'm gonna cook this, but...
I will send you the recipe. Definitely.
Yeah, I'd appreciate that, and then I'll even post it on the blog and everything, but...
Yeah, we've got pictures, all kinds of stuff, yeah.
So when you started doing, like, let's say the Iron Chef and judging, this is more of, like, almost like an acting role, like, you have to act like an Iron Chef, like, you know, really tough. So how was that for you, like... being, you know, playing a role almost?
You know what? It's difficult on Iron Chef, particularly when you're competing, because you hardly have time to cook, let alone talk and say and try to construct witty, pithy commentary, you know? So it's hard, and you have, like, 8 cameras on you at all times, at all angles, and it is acting, because they want you to be tough, especially when you're judging. You're supposed to be one of the toughest judges in America. But it's kind of, you know, fun as well, you know, because I obviously know my food and I know my stuff. I have a large repertoire of expertise, being a French-trained Korean-American Londoner. It doesn't matter what you throw at me. I probably had it before. I understand it, and I could probably make it. You know?
And did you ever make a contestant cry because you were so harsh in your judging?
No.
Did you see any of the contestants ever cry?
I've seen people cry when they lose. Yeah.
And how are they comforted? How do they deal with that? I don't think I could deal with that.
It's part of the competition. Somebody's got to win and somebody has to lose, you know? And you just say next time, or, you know, it's just, what can you say? You know, you cooked awesome, you know, like, we had to just pick somebody and it was minuscules above. And a lot of times with Iron Chef, it really is somebody is just a hairline fracture ahead of somebody else.
Wow, but there's some subjectivity to it, right? Like, because you're just determining everybody's got different taste buds.
Of course, and there's subjectivity to everything, you know. Everybody has different opinions on art, or, you know, judging sports, you know, there's a technical capability and execution as well as interpretation, same with music. So there's subjectivity in everything that we do, but I think that there is a certain standard of what is universally kind of delicious, almost. I wouldn't say that everybody has the same taste buds, but you, as a chef, you try to make something that is the most accessible and welcoming to all taste buds.
So, you know, you mentioned earlier that cooking is a lot like a science, and yet cooking's one of those things where, you know, you take, like, your grandmother's recipe and you tweak it a little bit and you do things and it's delicious. Like, it's one of those sciences that really depends on things that have been handed down for generations, as opposed to a lot of science, which kind of throws out earlier generations. Work, you know, like, take medicine as an example. Of course, we use some medicines from prior generations, but sometimes the medicines from prior generations we realize actually kills people. But with food, it seems like, oh, I've got my secret grandmother's recipe, and it's going to be the way I'm going to win. Like, what is it about cooking that, you know, how has science sort of moved along the art of cooking?
You know, I think it's both because there's some foods that have just died over the ages. You know, I was looking at some of the old Playboy Club menus from the 1960s and 70s in London, and they had things on there like turtle soup. Yeah. Like, nobody eats turtle soup anymore. And so I think that the food is just as dynamic as a lot of different industries as well. But, you know, there is this sense of nostalgia, and people have such strong food memories, and everybody, you know, remembers something that their mom used to make or something that their grandmother used to make, and it's so personal. I think that's part of the reason why certain recipes are handed down like heirloom.
Yeah. So like, what's a recipe your grandmother would cook that you have kind of upgraded?
Probably her silken tofu soup stew.
Mm.
It's good, and my mom makes it, which is really good. It hasn't changed that much, I would have to say. Like, maybe we use some nicer cuts of meat instead of Spam.
That would help.
Yeah. Yeah, and cut up hot dogs, like Korean War rations.
Although I'm starting to think the cut up hot dogs might be good.
Actually, there's a stew called budejjigae, which is made of all of the war rations. Where you have, you know, cut up Vienna sausages and Spam hanging out in there, some corn, like baked beans, so like whatever they could get their hands on was kind of thrown into this big pot and stewed up with some chilies and spice.
So Judy, probably a lot of people are listening to this and they're thinking, oh my gosh, this woman made a lot of interesting choices and she managed to live or pursue the career of her dreams. And a lot of people think to themselves, I can't do this. You know, what are the common excuses you think people have, and how do they get over them in order to recreate their careers? How do they find what they want to do? It seems like you found it because this was how you were spending your free time. But then once you find it, how do you start to aim yourself to make this leap that you've made?
You know what? I think a lot of it has to do with just kind of being brave. And, you know, figuring out what you love to do is part of it, you know, like, and I think that most, if not all, hobbies can be made into a career. If you love golf, you can find something in the golfing world to make that into a viable career, you know.
I totally agree with that.
Yeah, and I think that if you love what you do, that the money will eventually follow. And I think that it's really just about hard work and passion. And if you work hard and you're smart about the way you work and you're passionate about it, it'll happen eventually.
So it really helped you though that your spouse, your partner was also very supportive. I mean, what if somebody's spouse is not so supportive? Would you say find a new spouse, or what would you do? What would you tell that person?
I don't know. I mean, obviously with a partnership, it makes things more difficult because, you know, all of a sudden, like, You're not home at dinner because you're working every night for dinner. You're not home on Saturday night. You're swallowing the irony of working the party that you used to go to, you know. And
you're the help now.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, chefs are notorious for having ridiculously long hours, and it's an impact on the entire family. So obviously, you know, do what you love, but you know, you also love your family and you love your kids and you love your wife and or your husband. So there has to be something of a balance. But you can pursue careers in food where you're not working restaurant hours. I mean, you can be a food journalist, you can do food media, you can work in television for food, you can do, you know, recipe testing or development. So there's so many different things. You can be a food photographer, you know, there's so many different things that you can do within food that don't make you work, you know, nights and every single night.
So did you ever sit, when you were making this decision, did you ever sit down and kind of make a list of all of the possible ways you could break into this career, or did you have your heart fixed on kind of just one direction?
No, I didn't. I kind of, like, I've also had this weird thing within the food industry where my first job in the food industry was at Sevier Magazine. So I was working in editorial and in their test kitchen because I didn't want to work those hours. And so I was working regular business hours. And then it just kind of evolved into more things and working odd hours and then freelancing. And now now it's because I freelance and I work for myself, I kind of have this thing where it's feast or famine. I'm either ridiculously busy or I have nothing going on.
And when you have nothing going on, do you get stressed out? Do you like start making calls like, I need to get another show or I need to book something?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, obviously, but there's always so much that you can be doing, you know, like oh, I can work more on this, or I should contact this person and write this, or whatever, you know, like, so, like, right now I don't have another show lined up, but I'm working on my book, and I'm working on a new restaurant concept, and so there's always kind of things in the pipeline. If they're not immediately pressing, you're always looking ahead to the next big project.
What's a restaurant concept mean? Like, what are you thinking of?
I'm thinking of doing my own place. Yeah, outside.
And will it be like Korean or Korean American or Asian fusion or
modern Korean, kind of sexy, fashionable Korean food?
What does sexy mean in the context of food?
Just kind of an environment that is a sexy setting. So kind of cool, nice bar, good drinks concept, a place that you want to kind of hang out and has a fun vibe about it.
Can you make it in New York City so I can go and say, hey, I know the owner here, so just, I'm cool.
Yeah.
I'm a VIP here. You should make it in New York.
I would love to. Stay tuned. We'll see what happens. I have no idea.
And have you thought about doing like a cookbook? You know, kind of like an Anthony Bourdain style?
Yeah. My book's going to come out in 2015, so stay tuned for that as well.
Oh, good. And what's your husband think now?
Well, we're divorced now.
Oh my gosh, what happened? He was like my hero for a second.
I know. Not anymore.
Okay, you're my hero. But what happened? I'm sorry to hear this. Like what?
Oh, it's okay. It happens to, you know, more than half of the population these days in America. So
Well, I'm divorced and remarried as well. So
there you go. You're part of the statistic too.
But could he not handle the long hours?
He wasn't crazy about that, but I wasn't, you know, working like that all the time. It, you know, all that stuff gets complicated. And then
you started the TV show. You think he got a little jealous maybe or envious of how successful?
I don't know. I think it was the culmination of a lot of different things. It just gets messy and irreconcilable differences, traveling apart, stuff like that. You just drift.
When you were going through the divorce, did this make you a more harsh judge on the Iron Chef shows?
No, it doesn't
this
make you more harsh
bad.
Judge, but I know, exactly. But I think that, like, I don't think you should ever cook angry.
That's
you know,
really
because I think that energy gets transformed, transfers to the food somehow. Because like once I was really angry and I made brownies and they turned out to be like mean angry brownies, like they didn't taste good.
Did they make everyone who eat them angry? Like was the anger contagious in the food?
I don't think so. No, but like I just didn't think that they tasted as good. And it was a recipe that I made all the time. And for some reason, when I made them, because I was angry, they turned out angry.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Like, I agree with that. I don't know why I agree with that, but that seems to make a lot of sense to me, that you put your love into your art, and people are going to sense it and feel it.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, I mean, it is an outlet, you know, the plate is a canvas.
Let's say I have the bravery, and I have a supportive, you know, environment around me. What's kind of the next step if, you know, before I make this leap? Because let's say I have bills to pay and I want to make sure I'm making the right decision and I'm scared.
Yeah. I mean, you will get paid something. And a lot of people are in this industry, obviously, making money and living their life. So it's not like you're going to be homeless.
Right.
You know, it just depends what you're used to, you know. So if you're a banker or a lawyer or a consultant, yeah, you're going to downgrade your life, you know. but you know, there are thousands and thousands and thousands of people that work in this industry and do just fine and have families and have kids and like have apartments and roofs over their heads. So it's not that bad.
So I think kind of the message is, because not everybody wants to be a chef. Some people want to be writers. Some people want to be athletes or work in the sports industry or work in the marketing industry.
Yeah.
So, but just with every industry, I think it's an important point to remember is that there's thousands of people in that industry making a living, no matter what industry you're coming from.
Exactly.
The bravery comes in, though, where you actually went back to school and started from scratch when you were already at a pretty high point in your old industry. Like, how did you develop that bravery?
You know what? It's also just, it's how much you hate your current job, too. I think it's
you
part of it also.
It.
You know, so that motivates you. And also how much you love the industry you want to be in. You know, like if you love something that much and you have that much passion for it, you're going to want to do it and throw yourself into it.
I like what you were saying earlier, though, about all the different possibilities you had in the food industry. And I strongly encourage people to make a list of all the possibilities. So let's say you're interested in basketball, but you're obviously not 8 feet tall. Make a list of all the ways you could, you know, you could be a sports agent. You could write about basketball. There's many ways to make a living in any industry, no matter what your love is.
Definitely. I mean, you could even work in fields adjacent to basketball, like making basketball, like helping design things, like the ergonomics of basketball station chair or like seats or something, or you know, like it's like designing golf clubs even, or designing tennis rackets, or
it's so funny you mention that, because I once got really obsessed with making a new and better tennis racket, and I got really into the science of the strings and the materials and everything, but then I wasn't that interested in it, so I gave up. But it was fun for a brief moment. I considered it.
Yeah. I mean, you could, and in the food industry, you can work at Whole Foods. You know, you don't have to be a chef, per se. You can work in marketing at Whole Foods. You can work in their strategic development teams. You can bring your business skills that you garnered on Wall Street and work in their operating costs or whatever, you know, and figure out what their next strategic business development plans could be.
Well, is it fair to say that you've replaced or exceeded your income from your old industry with your new industry?
Not quite yet.
Wow, that's impressive. Given all the TV shows, all of the your chef here, chef there, all the appearances.
Yeah, no, I haven't.
Wall Street, man, is just
level,
hard to beat.
But I will, and I'm sure I will surpass that. Yeah.
It sounds like you're having a lot more fun, though.
I am, and definitely, like if I had stayed in finance, I would be making a ton more money now than I am now in cooking. I mean, like the you just can't compete with the salaries in those industries, in the cooking world. But I'm a much happier person. I'm a better person for it, and life is too short not to do what you love.
Yeah, I agree with that. So now I was going to ask you all sorts of questions about bond convexity, but it doesn't sound like you're really into that at all.
Nope, I left that world behind me. Yeah,
but the economy does affect you. Like if you're thinking of opening up a restaurant, you've got to get investors. You've got to find a great location. You've got to got to hope the economy is going strong. So if you're expensive, you could charge those prices.
Exactly. Yeah, you have to write an entire business model, figure out what all their costs are, your overheads, what you have to, you know, cost each dish, what your markup's going to be. I mean, it's running a business, and it's math.
How many restaurants succeed?
I think in New York, there's something like an 80 or 85% closure rate within the first 3 to 5 years.
Wow. I mean, there's so many restaurants in New York. Every block's got like 5 restaurants. I can understand, but 85%, I didn't realize it was that high.
Something like that. Don't quote me on that, but it was shockingly high. Yeah.
Why does anybody even start a restaurant then?
Because people love food.
Yeah.
I think that there are a lot of restaurants that are started by vanity projects. And I think there are a lot of talented chefs out there who make great food, but they're very poor businessmen.
So what are mistakes that they make? What are like the most common mistakes a chef might make? or a restaurateur.
Things on the menu that he thinks will sell, but then don't, and not changing them quickly enough. You really have to create a menu that is welcoming and accessible for everyone. And I think that a lot of chefs treat their restaurants like vanity projects, and they're like, well, they should eat it this way because this is the way I want them to eat it, where they should really be making a product that is tailored towards their customers' taste.
I have an idea for you that you can use to test out. Let's say you're opening up a restaurant in New York and you have 200 ideas for recipes. You should make Facebook ads. Get the recipe for these Korean buffalo wings, Korean-style buffalo wings. And, you know, have a landing page with you know, maybe the recipe or maybe the landing page to your restaurant. It doesn't matter. And then you see, of the 200 Facebook ads that you create, one for each recipe, you see what the top 30 click-through rates are. Like, which ads got the most clicks? And there's your menu.
Exactly. It's like burgers, fried chicken, tacos.
I guess that's true, but you could target though New York. You could target like people of certain jobs, so you get certain income levels. You could target like an age group or male, female, so you can you know, so it won't just be kids. You could target like the exact demographic your restaurant's going to cater to.
Yep, that's excellent. A great idea.
I come up with an idea every now and then. It's not so bad. So, Judy, I really hope your restaurant does open up in New York because I'm going to eat there. And good luck on when's your book coming out? In the middle of 2015?
Probably more towards the end. Yeah.
Well, I hope you can come back on the show when your book comes out, or when you ever have any project coming up. We'll be happy to talk again. It'll be fun.
Love to. Thank you so much.
Thank you, and I think the empowering message here is, you know, do what you love. And I think everybody does have things that they love. Sometimes it's a little difficult to find what it is, but I think it's there, and it's okay to play around a little while to find what it is, but
completely.
You know, and do the work and build the foundation and the house gets built.
Amazing. Yeah, definitely.
So thanks again, Judy, and good luck.
Thank you.
And thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it, and we'll definitely speak again.
Yes, definitely. Thank you.
For more from James, check out the James Altucher Show on the Stansberry Radio Network at stansberryradio.com and get yourself on the free insiders list today.
Who doesn't love a classic chocolate chip cookie? Famous Amos has been making them since the 70s, 1975 to be exact. With semi-sweet chocolate chips and a satisfying crunch, it's everything classic in one bite-sized cookie, and fans couldn't get enough. That's right. You'll find our original recipe, the one you know and love, in every bag of Famous Amos original chocolate chip cookies. Find Famous Amos anywhere you buy your favorite snacks.